Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Match Volume Podcast. I'm your host, Emily Rose Raboy, and I hope you're surviving midterm season. Here on Match Volume, we talk to people you might never get the chance to meet otherwise. So turn up that volume and let's start the show. As an actor, I walk into auditions and my quote-unquote type immediately pops into the director's mind. My type is the innocent girl next door, and although I sometimes fit this type in my everyday life, it doesn't define me. On stage and screen, I love to play villains and vixens and everything in between, but often directors cast actors based solely on their types, and no matter how good an actor you are, you can never truly escape typecasting. Whether you're acting or just being yourself, it is difficult to challenge the perception of what you physically look like. This issue is amplified in the real world for minorities of all types, whether based on race, gender, sexual orientation, or ability. Our first interview focuses on race and the idea of otherness. Maya Williams sat down with NPR reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji. Shireen writes about race for the radio show Code Switch, and she'll be discussing her article about a skiing event that draws African-American skiers and snowboarders.
One of the most recent stories I listened to of yours, which is the Black Summit, your opening lead about snowflakes.
We all know the old adage, every snowflake is different, except for one thing. They're all white, and so are a majority.
So I was typing that line, and when I write, I talk out loud, and everyone was like, what? That's awesome. Are you going to say that in your story? And I was like, well, can I say that in my story? And I talked to one of the editors and she's like, yes, you can say that. You should say that.
I kind of get this vibe that how you guys sort of put things together, work together at Code Switch is you're having these conversations where,
exactly.
Is it okay to say this? What's PC? What's diplomatic? And those are the types of conversations that people are so afraid to have in the workplace.
So many of our stories come about is just we're chopping it up about something that we read, or we have these random conversations that turn into stories. Why do people say every snowflake is different? Because they're not all different.
The skiing and, you know, Black people skiing, it's something that you don't think of. It's almost like the stereotype of Black people don't swim. But I feel like Code Switch is highlighting the other, but also bringing up how there's this sameness and this commonality.
You know, to be perfectly honest, that story, I was like, who's going to care about this? Honestly, I was like, okay, Black people skiing. I mean, I feel like maybe in the 70s, that would be a big deal. So when I got out there and I was in Aspen before the National Brotherhood of Skiers came in, I was like, wow, this is the whitest place I have ever seen. Shockingly white and shockingly wealthy. I mean, it is the 1%. To the extreme. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I was like, wow. And then the next day, there were 2,000 African Americans out in Aspen. And I was like, this is a story. And there is a way to tell this story. And it isn't just, oh, look, Black people ski.
Another story that it was a while ago, but you did one about Juan Pablo, the first ethnic bachelor. But someone you interviewed in that piece said something interesting, which is the way we are treated is a product of how we're perceived.
I feel like if you go, not Code Switch, but a lot of the stories that we do about people of color have to do with like really hard-hitting issues like immigration or child poverty, these issues which paint a picture of people of color as poor, needy, uneducated, et cetera, and the list goes on. And actually, no, there are African-American middle-class people who go to Aspen and ski, and we never talk about them. Why don't we ever talk about them? I think about that a lot, especially when I'm pitching stories like this, because I know people are going to be like, well, who cares? Like, why do we care about that? But I think these are important stories, yeah. Too. I mean, they paint a full picture of what it means to be a person of color living in the United States. It's not all we're in struggling schools and we're poor. That's part of it. It's not all about inequality. That's part of it. You know, we're just doing regular things like going skiing.
You have a very diverse array of stories that you go for. What sort of draws you to something?
I think it's stereotype busting. If you go through all of those stories, every single one of those stories is busting a stereotype in some way. Desiree Akhavan, who is Iranian-American, but then she's bisexual. Mm-hmm. Steven Yeun, who is the sex symbol from The Walking Dead, but he's Asian. I think that I'm drawn to those types of stories. Maybe it's because I don't fit into a box, but I love, you know, taking these ideas that we have of people of color and just, like, exploding them.
That's what's so interesting to me about the Bachelor piece. On the surface, it's this sort of, like, fluffy, melodramatic TV show, but the power that it could have to see someone of color fall in love on TV and be just like you and just like me, and it's not always about struggle and poverty, that sort of level of representation that's missing.
Why isn't there more of that? Why isn't there more of that?
It's frustrating.
I don't get it. I wish I had the answer.
Shake your fist.
I think there's not more of that because we're not in positions of power when it comes to the networks, the main networks. We just are not in the executive suite. Well, Shonda Rhimes has figured it out, which is just do stories that we all love, stories about passion and love and intrigue and sex and death and murder, and then just put brown people in there.
Yeah, it's in a way, I mean, it's sort of like normalizing otherness.
Also, are we just not running into each other enough in the world? Are we like resegregating or something so that only white people interact with other white people? And only brown people are interacting with brown people. I'm just trying to understand why this is happening. I mean, the people in the executive suite, they must just see other white people and live in neighborhoods with only white people. So that is their reality.
So one last question for you. When you go to the movies, when you're watching the news or watching television, what do you want to see?
I always want a compelling story. And I want a satisfying ending to that compelling story. I just want to leave feeling full. And of course I want to see people that look like me and people who sound like me, but number one, I want a compelling story, and I want the story to be well told. So that's what I'm looking for.
That was NPR reporter Shireen Marisol Meraji speaking with Maya Williams. You can listen to Shireen's radio stories on Code Switch. We're moving from a discussion about race to another type of otherness. Megan Coyle sat down with Nate Galtieri, who just transitioned from female to male. Nate is a screenwriting student at USC, and he talked about how other people make up their own narratives for him because he doesn't fit in their traditional ideas of gender. For now, he's okay with that, but here he is telling his own story.
I guess we'll start with, how did you know that you weren't comfortable in your own body?
So I think that's a good question, because it's not really the same for everybody. Some people know when they're very, very young, so they'll know when they're like 2 or 3 or, you know, 4. And I didn't really figure it out until I was like 18 years old, pretty much. And I think for me, it kind of manifested as this general feeling of like discomfort. For a long time, it was more like cognitive dissonance and a general feeling of discomfort and kind of extended like daydreaming and fantasies about like wanting to be male, or like, you know, thinking of myself as male, even though like I knew I was not perceived that way. It feels to me like you want to take your skin off, like you just don't want to exist in a physical form. And I knew that like I was very uncomfortable with my hips. I remember seeing like a video of myself that was taken, and I was like, I don't know who that is. And then the kind of the watershed moment, I guess, was when I this is a terrible thing, I don't think this at all, I'm so sorry, but what I googled was, is being a woman a curse? I just could not deal with it anymore. I couldn't take living that way anymore. And so that's kind of, it kind of just led me to this general topic until I realized this was a thing that people pursued and kind of could do, and other people felt like this. So
what age were you when you had that?
When I Google searched that when I was 18. Obviously, I knew what transgender people were before that, but I just didn't really connect, I guess, with that. Especially because, you know, usually you see it, you see people who were like designated male at birth transition to become female. So kind of the other way around isn't really as publicized, I guess.
So what was the next step after you realized?
Well, I guess the next step was kind of more like, you know, since I wasn't somebody who knew when I was very young, I was like, I want to make sure that this is exactly the way I feel, that this is the name for, you know, what I've been feeling. So I gave myself kind of a timeline, and I was like, all right, I would love, you know, if I could wave a magic wand and change my body right now, I would, absolutely. But I was saying, okay, I'm going to wait 2 years and see if I still feel this way and feel it as strongly as I do right now. So I kind of gave myself time to think it over, and explored it for a few months, and then I kind of slowly started exploring, like, okay, you know, dressing a little more male and, like, trying to go out in public and see if people read me as male and, like, which, half and half, let's, not too much, but kind of, so it's kind of, you kind of slowly start accumulating, I guess, things or ideas that, like, you know, maybe I do fit into this. I talked to a lot of people who were and were not transgender. I talked to a lot of therapists. They'll write a letter of recommendation for you, like, oh, okay, we can ask this endocrinologist to prescribe you testosterone or estrogen or whatever hormone you're going to take. So that's what I did. I started July 31st, 2015. And so it's been over a year. So I think it's a year and, what is this, 3 months?
And what kinds of changes have you experienced? Are you happy with them?
Yeah, definitely. But your face kind of masculinizes in a way that you cannot quite explain. Your body kind of, you know, it loses a lot of the more feminine curves that you'll have. And you'll get a lot more body hair. You're not ready for it. Like, it's way more than you think is going to happen.
Were you ever scared at any point, like, going through this whole thing?
Yeah. I think you should be scared, honestly. I think it's kind of a weird sign if you're not a little scared. Even in the little steps taking, like trying to present as male, even before taking hormones, but I was also scared taking hormones. Some changes are reversible, but a lot are not, and a lot of the ones that are very noticeable are not changeable or reversible.
And how did your family and friends react?
So I have a twin sister, and she was, you know, she was fine with it. She got all my clothes. She was excited. You know, I think family, like, they took it very well. One half of my family actually still does not know, my mom's half, so they don't, it's like, I have not seen them for a year. It's been really weird.
Are you planning on telling them?
I'm going to have to, so I don't know. at some point, I don't know.
So now that you're at this point, how do you know when you should tell people about this?
Yeah, this is actually a very interesting problem that came up today. So it's not something that I really actively hide, and I'm pretty, you know, I'm mentioned on Facebook sometimes. I'm pretty casual about it. And I think that's because I can afford to be, because I live in Southern California and I go to USC, and, you know, it's not terribly dangerous for me. I usually don't tell them unless it's, like, incredibly pertinent or if I'm really getting to know them very well. So, you know, like, the ice hockey team I play on is the women's team. So, you know, I tell them kind of soon, because otherwise it'd be like, why am I on this team? I don't know. I think most people assume that I'm, like, someone's younger brother. Just, like, weird stuff. They just kind of make up their own narrative in their head. I'm like, all right, whatever you want. So, I don't know.
That doesn't bother you at all that people make up this narrative for you?
That doesn't really bother me, per se. And it's weird because there are different contexts where I would want people to know and different contexts where, like, I would not want people to know. But, you know, I think also, people who don't know, they usually find out through just, like, social media things or Facebook, and I'm kind of okay with that, kind of not overt, more just kind of, you know, they find out on their own time, or if they happen to stumble across it, I'm okay with that.
So is there, like, one thing that you wish the public and everyone else knew about transgender people?
I think the one thing that I would have people understand is that, you know, even though, you know, some people might have never identified as, you know, the gender that they were, I guess, they're assigned sex, so people who have never identified with that, there is still a very, like, unique perspective. And in a way, like, that's, when people say that they're proud of being transgender, the way that I see that is, like, there is a certain weird pride in, like, saying that, like, I've seen life from these two very, very different sides, because there is a huge dichotomy in, like, being seen as male or female in society, and it's a very, very interesting space to inhabit, and I'm, like, weirdly honored to be able to inhabit that space. As for what it really means to be transgender, what it means to me, and maybe as a larger community, it's like you occupy almost a space outside of yourself, which is kind of really cool.
That's awesome. And I feel like that could help in, like, for something like you do, like, you screenwrite, right? And so, yeah. Like, I mean, I feel like having that perspective could really benefit, like, the kinds of things you do, right?
Yeah. Hopefully. I mean, you know, I don't think a lot of people are like, you know, oh, I can't write women. Like, that's not, like, you're writing people. You're not writing women. Like, that's not, you know what I mean? I think it helps in a way to see, like, there's different ways that people act with each other. And so it's helpfully, like, I know how women and women interact. And I know how men and men interact. And I know how men and women interact. And kind of things in between that. So it is kind of helpful. And I think, you know, also as a writer, I guess it's helpful to be able to like make a larger effort to maybe get movies, like, I mean, as if I'm gonna get there, but like make movies about that kind of thing that aren't kind of written by people who've not really experienced you know, being transgender or something. Because I know that's a huge thing right now with like Stonewall and like About Ray and The Danish Girl. There's like, these movies are not really written properly or, you know, to portray transgender people. So
so interesting. Wow. Perhaps we'll see you writing those kinds of stories someday. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was USC student Nate Galtieri talking with Match Volume producer Megan Coyle. Our next segment is coming straight out of left field. Two USC alums, Kai Sato and Brenton Sullivan, created Field Level, a startup that brings the world of college sports online. It's a social network for sports recruiters, coaches, and athletes.
So I want to know a little bit about how Field Level started. I understand that it has its origins at USC, so I'm curious, how did the idea come about? How did you guys meet?
Kai and I actually have a long history together. We went to rival boarding schools. I went to Thatcher, which is in Ojai, Southern California, and Kai went to Kate, which is in Carpinteria. And we met each other on the sports fields. I guess we played basketball against each other, but also met each other just through some collaboration that our schools were doing together for college recruitment. And ultimately, we both showed up at SC on the and kind of joined forces there in our senior year. I guess a little bit late junior year, we were talking about technology and YouTube and what it was doing to sort of sports. And during our discussions, what really came about was that recruitment could be a really interesting sort of aspect of how technology was going to shift things. And the reason why it resonated with us was because we felt like we had both had this personal pain of going to these very small boarding schools that didn't really put any focus on helping athletes ascend to the next level of sport.
We wanted to go play college sports. We are not alone in that. There are millions of kids that want to figure out whether you're going to play at Cornell or USC or anything in between, Division III programs, things like that. It was just really complicated to get on the radar of college coaches. And you go to these events and there's all sorts of money that's spent oftentimes frivolously. So we recognize that technology could play a unique part, and Field Level is designed to level that recruiting field. So bringing college coaches and high school coaches together on a platform that was very different than Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn and some of the other social networks that we saw at the time, it was really tailored to solve this recruiting problem. And so to where we've arrived now, we are the biggest recruiting platform in collegiate baseball, football, lacrosse, men's basketball, and just launched soccer. And when we say that, we work with the vast majority of college programs. We also work with tens of thousands of high schools and then hundreds of thousands of athletes who are on our platform. And there's a lot more that goes into it, which we can elaborate on, than just stats and video, which are commonly thrown out in the recruiting world. But ultimately, bringing the necessary parties together is the secret sauce of making recruiting truly scale.
The reason why we created this platform was because it absolutely would have transformed our lives and given us better opportunities. Now, we both ended up at USC. We both went there for academics. I'm not saying that we would ever want to change that. SC was a fabulous school, and obviously we met each other and started a business out of it. So everything worked out for the better. But having the opportunity to just see, you know, where our athletic careers could have gone, you never want to hang it up. You want to continue to play.
I know that you said that you're not technically a startup, you're not, you know, traditionally the type of company that would join an accelerator program. So what sort of advantages did you guys see in joining this program?
This program's first of its kind. Back to the standard model of accelerators, it's we have an idea, they help further us along, give us some office space, maybe a little bit of money, and then we build out an initial product, and then we raise even more money when it concludes. For us, it's very strategic. There are some very high level kind of opportunities in content, whether it's working with some of the big media companies, also on data. So social networks are all about their data, and we have years of it now, right? We've built this company over several years, and so we have some pretty unique insights that we're now kind of taking to the market. And true to its name, this program has helped accelerate that, making sure that we're meeting the right people, getting great feedback, very similar to how we built the initial platform at Field Level. We're always doing a lot of customer discovery and talking to people before things go to market. But it's been pretty fascinating because, I mean, even one of the largest leagues, we won't say which one, they said, well, we were looking for a solution like you guys, and we tried to build it for years, and you guys have scaled this. So that's obviously really validating, and it was just a matter of getting in front of the right people. And so that's what's been so unique about this, because we might have 4 or 5 meetings a day right now with people that are potential partners, potential clients, all sorts of stuff. And so true to its name, it really has pushed some of those initiatives along.
You just heard from Kai Sato and Brenton Sullivan, who spoke with Brian Bencomo. That's it for this edition of Match Volume. The producer is Megan Coyle. Match Volume is a podcast of Annenberg Radio News and the Media Center at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Emily Rose Raboy. Thanks for listening.